Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everyone. It's Matt again. Just giving you some more links that you can find in the description page to help benefit the Black Lives Matter movement. First off, we have seen some fantastic progress over the past month, but there is still so much change that needs to happen, which is why we are still seeing protests and demands for accountability. While Louisville has now passed a law banning no-knock warrants in honor of Breonna Taylor, the officers who are responsible for her death have still not been arrested and charged. There are so many funds and petitions right now on behalf of Breonna Taylor that if you're looking to help, it can be overwhelming to know where to start. If that's the case for you, I recommend going to the Fight for Breonna website, justiceforbreonna.org, so you can learn more about Breonna's case, sign up so you can receive updates, and learn more about how you can help through donating and educating. If you're looking to support a Black-owned business, I'd like to recommend this week Body Space Fitness. Let's be real, quarantine has done a number on our minds and bodies, and while your gym may be opening up in the near future, can you honestly tell me that you're going to feel 100% comfortable going back right away? Probably not. That is why Body Space Fitness is offering personalized one-on-one virtual training. These are virtual Zoom sessions with their private trainers who will curate personalized workout routines designed specifically for you, your body, and your goals. During these sessions, they will instruct you on your workout as well as offer you feedback in real time during your training. This isn't just like a YouTube pop sugar video. These are designed for you and meant to help you while you're doing them. You can learn more about this by visiting the website bodyspacefitness.com and clicking on live one-to-one virtual training. Our third link is for Broadway for Racial Justice, which again, you can find in the description box with the previously mentioned pages. The link is bfrj.org, but I'm going to hold off on going into actual detail about the organization because this one was selected by our episode's guest, Charlie Franklin, who will be explaining more about it at the end of the episode. So thanks for listening, guys, and enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody out there. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown, my obsession. I am your semi-host these days, Matt Koplik. With me is a Broadway juvenile. He is blonde-haired, blue-eyed, currently sporting a goatee, which is, if I must be honest, sir, it looks a little glued on. I'm calling your bluff on this.
You know, I've never been able to grow this, so it looks glued on to me. It's very odd to see it on my face.
You look in the mirror and you're like, who's that guy? You know him from Book of Mormon, Bridges in Madison County, and most recently, Tina, the Tina Turner musical. Please welcome to the pod, Mr. Charles or Charlie? I should have asked
you. I could go into that story if you want.
Okay. Charles Charlie Franklin.
There you go.
Okay. I probably should have asked you that before we recorded, but I'm not a professional, so there you go.
I have people call me both. Long story short, there was already a Charles Franklin at Actors Equity, and I had to choose a different name, so I went with Charlie. But I, you know, half the people in the world still call me Charles, so call me whatever you want.
Just call me. Just call me. To quote RuPaul, as long as you call me. How are you doing today, Mr. Franklin?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah?
I'm doing all right, yeah.
Where are we finding you these days?
I am in St. George, Utah, at my girlfriend's house.
Ah, very nice, very nice. And it is hot there, you said, correct?
Hot. It is hot.
Very hot. Yeah. Is it also like humid there? Like it would be?
It's not. No, it's pretty great. Yeah. Okay. It's the nice balance of, you know, if you're out in the sun, you're like, oh, that's hotter than any sun I've ever felt in my life. But if you're in the shade, it's like, this isn't so bad. It's not humid. It's just a nice, pleasant outdoor experience.
The outdoors. I have forgotten what they are. But you know what? I'm a city kid. I'm a theater kid. I'm a young Jewish gay boy. I've never really known the outdoors. I've always been partial to inside. What was your exposure into the theater?
Okay, so my mom is a voice teacher. She has her master's in opera, which she got in Germany. And when I was about 8, I think, there was a production of The King and I happening in Albany, and I went and saw it, and it was, I guess I wouldn't say at the time it was eye-opening. Obviously, it introduced me to, well, I guess I wouldn't say it introduced me to theater either, because Sound of Music was my favorite growing up, but it introduced me to live theater, and it sparked something in me, because my family started doing shows, all of us. There's four kids and my mom. My dad's done a couple too, but and then at age 9 I did a production of Camelot, and from then on out, it was, if my mom could get me into the audition room, I would enjoy it.
Oh, were you that little boy at the end of the show in Camelot?
I was not. I didn't get that role.
Then who the fuck
I was just
you?
A page boy. You know, I had one line, and it was, "The queen is at the stake, your majesty. Shall I signal the torch? Your majesty, your majesty." And that's probably about how I said it, because I didn't understand acting at all.
No, I mean, we get older, we get wiser. We still don't truly understand acting. To be honest, I don't understand Camelot. Did you end up going off to school to do theater?
I did. I went to Pace.
Pace, very nice. And then from Pace, what came next?
My senior year, halfway through my senior year, I booked the swing in Bridges in Madison County.
Halfway through your senior year.
Yes. And at that point, I had a couple of classes left that I was taking, and they allowed me to figure out how to take them through also doing it. You know, being in New York, it wasn't that hard. Yes, I had to get up at 8 o'clock on my day off to go to school, but, you know, it could have been worse.
You are, I think, the third person recently who's like, oh yeah, I booked this Broadway show or like this national tour while I was in school. And I'm just sitting here like, you know what? I see you and I hate you. And I
there's
wanna be the
no first. Part of me that does not feel unbelievably lucky and grateful for that. You know, it's saying it. Yes, it's nonchalant at this point because I've lived it. It's past. But, you know, at that time, it was something. It wasn't real to me yet. And I know how special it is, and I know how lucky I had it.
Yeah, I'm still going to hate you for the rest of this episode.
You're allowed to.
Thank you. I appreciate. So, Bridges in Madison County. Tell me a little, how would you sort of sum up that experience in a nutshell, if you can, if you're able?
Ooh, Kelly and Steve. I mean, come on. I got to watch that show over 50 times, and what I saw of them doing, what I learned from them, it was just so cool. It was just so cool to watch these two brilliant people do what they did. And they're not the only ones. That entire cast was so special.
Very good.
I mean, anyone who saw the show, I'll never hear the end of it. And I agree with everything that they say. It was really special.
What's Kelly O'Hara like in rehearsal? Sort of like, what's her process? Were you able to watch most of it?
So as Swings, we were brought in at the end of Tech Week.
Oh, okay.
Not at the end of Tech Week, at the end of the rehearsal room process. So we were brought in for Tech Week to learn the
show.
So I actually will never really know what she was like from the start. We were at the meet and greet, and she was so kind and lovely. And then after that, I just got to see what was close enough to a finished product. But I can tell you that backstage, she's about as lovely as can be. She is always the one. She's a leader. She's in charge of keeping everyone sane, and she does a heck of a job.
That's lovely. I'm always sort of on the fence when it comes to the divas I love, where it's like, I want them to be perfect, but at the same time, I kind of want to hear stories, not about like them being awful, but like about them being a little gross. Like I want to hear a story of Laura Benanti backstage at Gypsy smashing Oreos and then snoring them. Like that's what I want to hear. I want to hear the like during Great Comet, Philippa Sue like had gummy bears stuck in her costume so she could eat the gummy bears during the show.
You know, I hear those stories sometimes about people, and I'm not usually the one to spread those stories. I'd rather, you know, the ones that stick in my mind are the ones of people doing extra good things.
That's
unfortunately funny. I'm boring for a podcast.
It's fine. I am extra snarky for the both of us. One of my favorite stories is Andrea McArdle when she was Fantine in Les Mis on Broadway the first time.
Yeah.
By that I mean when Les Mis was on Broadway the first time, not that she played Fantine multiple times on Broadway.
Sure.
But anyone who knows Les Mis, or at least the original production, you know, everybody kind of doubles throughout the show, and Fantine plays a bullet boy on the barricade in Act Two. And I guess at some point in her run, Andrea McArdle had gotten really good at sort of sneaking snacks in. So she had M&Ms that she like would put into a specific pocket in her costume. And then one night during Bring Him Home, she's supposed to be sleeping on the barricade and she turned just a little too much. And in the middle of Bring Him Home, this quiet little lullaby, you hear a raining of M&Ms going through the barricade.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Like, that's the messy shit I love.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
I think it's time we go into Mr. Charles Charlie Franklin's obsession today, which is about uniting and then dividing.
Or dividing and then uniting.
Depending on how you...
depending on which character you're following.
Exactly, depending on the timeline. What is your obsession today?
Oh, man, it is of Jason Robert Brown's The Last 5 Years.
Yes,
and
the
I've
other Jason
probably
Robert
been waiting my entire life to talk about this at length. It is one of those things where, you know, if I am on a long road trip, if I have time to kill, if I was in my teens at any point, that was playing. It is... It's special. It's smart, lyrically, musically. I mean, I'm also, just to preface this podcast, I am such a music and lyric snob and nerd. Like, I'll be like, oh, did you hear that A sus 4 sharp 9 chord? And you know, anyone that I'm with is like, shut up. Obviously, I wouldn't say that because I don't, I mean, maybe I would, who knows, but you know, something like that.
Sure.
And you know, I'll be the first one to be like, that internal rhyme, how did they think of it? So I'm ready for that because there's
I'm here for that. I mean, I studied music theory in college. I can't rightfully say that all of it stuck, but if I can't put the name to the musical phrase, I at least acknowledge when a moment in composing or orchestrating really kind of gets me. I'm particularly a sucker for orchestrations, which is why actually in regards to The Last 5 Years, I don't know if you've listened to all the major recordings of it. There are three major recordings. Yes. I am a fan of the orchestrations for all three because they're all different and they're all fantastic. They're all different.
And you know, what's fun about it is the minimal use of percussion. Because the percussion is involved with either the voice of the actor or the instruments that are not usually percussion instruments.
Yeah. I am a giant slut for percussion in orchestrations. I love a deep drum beat. I love it when it's, you know, just it hits you in the soul.
Yep.
I said this, I think... So I just had Antoine L. Smith on, and I had mentioned, oh, he's the best. I had mentioned, God damn it, another phone call. I had just mentioned an audio I have of the final performance of Michael John McHugh's Wild Party, which perhaps was not obtained legally, and people can come for me for that. I don't fucking care. The percussion, it's worth listening to just because whoever is the drummer in that pit in that final performance is giving his life and his blood and sweat, and you just hear it and it just like hits you in the pelvis, and that's the shit I love. So for me to say that I like the orchestrations in Last 5 Years where there is either no percussion, or at least no drum set, or in the movie where it's a very light drum set, that's saying something.
I have a funny story about orchestrations before we get into Last 5 Years. It does pertain to Jason Robert Brown. I'm a sucker for orchestrations. I will point out a specific thing and I'll be like, do you know why he did that? Do you know why she did that? Do you know why they did that? Because this is happening in the words. This is happening in the feeling. And everyone around me, again, is just like, oh God, here we go.
Yeah.
But there's a song in Bridges where I had pointed out a string orchestration to him over Facebook Messenger because I had been listening. And for some reason, my ears had never picked it up. Mm-hmm. And it's in the song, Look at Me. And there is some section where these strings are so beautifully flowing. And I messaged him on Facebook saying, you know, these strings at this time in this recording, I don't know why I've never heard them. They're absolutely spectacular. So beautiful. Just, you know, reminding you how wonderful you are at writing music and whatever. And his genius response was just, you're just hearing them, because that's Jason Robert Brown. Yeah. And I love everything about it.
to him, it's so obvious. To us, it's like, oh my God, do you know how many times it took me to listen to the original Another 100 People from Company and finally hear the moment of the orchestrations where Jonathan Tunick puts in the Bobby Baby Bobby Bubby? I'm embarrassed to say how long it took me to hear that.
See, now I'm excited to go back and listen to that and find that.
Oh, absolutely. I'm talking the original Company. Pam Myers, listen to it. I think it's in the halfway point, because at first, you know, the orchestra is just sort of backing her up all over the place, and then the second time she gets to the chorus, it's in the chorus, and that, or they find each other in the crowded streets, you hear bada 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 bada. And that's not in the music itself. That is something that the orchestrator Jonathan Tunick put in.
Yeah,
it's like, just, you know, just fuck me, you know. That's all I have to say.
And at some point, like, there's part of me that wants to go, oh, they were just being lazy. They copy and paste it, you know. But no, of course not.
Oh.
Of course not.
Never. So how did you come to find the last 5 years? You said it was in high school?
Yeah, I think it might have been either late middle school it was probably high school. One of my friends introduced me to it. I think my friend Tori. And he was just like, yeah, check this out. It's really good. And at that point, I was kind of just getting into expanding out of just whatever show I was doing, listening to more theater. Mm-hmm. And it stuck with me immediately. I thought it was so beautiful. I thought it was so tough to listen to. I was also in my teenage hormonal years where, you know, anything mm-hmm. was tough to listen to, but I also was like beginning relationships. So to have these two different kinds of people experimenting with these, you know, relationship with this relationship differently, it was hard. At some points I felt like the Jamie, at some points I felt like the Kathy. It was, you know, that's my young teenage self being a theater nerd.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of self-awareness to recognize when you're being a Jamie, I think.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And I immediately called myself out on that bullshit. I remember being in the car with my dad and I had just broken up with a girl and I hadn't slept with women and all that stuff, but I was like, you know what, Dad, I feel like a Jamie. He was like, yeah, well, you got a lot of life left to live before you feel like a Jamie at its fullest extent and everything. But you know, it's tough stuff.
So what is the last 5 years about exactly for anyone who's listening and doesn't really know?
So the last 5 years tells the story of this couple, Jamie and Kathy. From Jamie's point of view, it goes from the when they first meet up until the relationship ultimately fails. And from Kathy's point of view, it starts at the failing relationship when he has left her and ends with him leaving her at her doorstep after their first date.
Yep. That is the, I don't want to say gimmick, but that's the thing that the last 5 years is perhaps best known for. It's a two-person musical where the characters sing mostly about themselves and about each other from opposite timelines, and they only cross over once. And when do they cross over?
Right in the middle at the proposal. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so beautiful. And they sing together for the only time.
Only time. I never knew that there was actually dialogue in the last 5 years until watched the bootleg with Cher Renee Scott and Norbert Leo Butz. And then by the time I saw it at second stage, I was prepared. But like, I was like, oh, they're speaking?
Yep. I was kind of struck by that as well. I saw a community theater production in Albany back in high school, and it hit just as hard as listening to it, you know?
Oh yeah. I would say for me, I kind of preferred listening to the last 5 years than watching it, but I think that's sort of the way almost like a concept album is. You know, like when people listen to Tommy for the first time or Evita for the first time, they had an image in their head of how it should look, how it should move. So everyone has their own opinion about it. Which is why like no production is going to satisfy everybody. It's one of those shows where it's like you listen to it, you have your image, and then it almost never works out the way you want it to.
Yeah, it's true. And I will always say I don't think anyone could have done it the way that Norbert and Cherry did. And then every single time I see a production, whether it be I saw the second stage, I saw the mm-hmm. concert with Joshua Henry and Cynthia Erivo, and every time I leave going, nope, that was it.
Yeah.
And then I go back to the album and I go, wait, no, this is it. It's mm-hmm. just, it's because it's, yes, it's in the performance, but it's also in the writing.
And
you can't have your performers save your writing because at that point you go, okay, well, you know, it's really good until it's not. But with this, it's always good.
Jamie decides it's his right to decide.
Jamie's got secrets she doesn't confide, and I'm still hurting.
So let's start at the beginning and see where it takes us.
Sure. We open on on Kathy. She's she has a letter in her hand, I believe. Yes. Yeah, she has a letter from Jamie.
As I know. Well, but even before, well, I guess during that, but there's that beautiful waltz music that, you know, is not in any vocal selections book you're going to find. But it opens and ends the show, which I think is so lovely. You know, it's a waltz. It implies that there's two people together. And it is both melodic and dissonant. And just to skip ahead to the end, because it's, I'm going to get off topic. It opens the show so beautifully. And then at the end of the show, it closes it so beautifully and ends on that one note, as if to say, it is gone. It is done. We're ending on the tonic, which, you know, to the not musical theater people is the key that we're in. It is just a stunning way of saying, and chapter closed.
And dramatically speaking, just in terms of musical storytelling, that waltz is not just a random waltz. It's also the waltz that they dance to at their wedding. You'll hear it, you hear it in the next 10 minutes. And it's also the melody for Jamie's goodbye in I Could Never Rescue You.
Ooh, so that,
yeah, it's an example of using the same motif constantly for different purposes. An example that I love to use, because I know that like Andrew Lloyd Webber always gets sort of dragged for reusing melodies in his shows. And sometimes, you know, I can understand, like, in Phantom, I can't necessarily tell you why all the melodies are repeated. Les Mis, though, is a show where I'm like, every single time they reuse the melody, it's for a purpose. So an example being Valjean's soliloquy, What Have I Done, Sweet Jesus, What Have I Done? And then Javert's Suicide is the exact same song, note for note, different keys, but note for note. And it's dramatically there for a reason. It's a turning point for both men. And for Valjean, at the end, he chooses life. And for Javert, he chooses death. Same crossroads, different decisions on both parts.
Gosh, I love it.
Yes. So I'm not saying that Jason Robert Brown watched Les Mis. He's like, I'm going to do that, but for divorce. But no. Maybe he did. I don't know.
Yeah. So, yeah. Still hurting. It's so lovely. It's got that beautiful instrumental section with the cellos in the beginning. Cello and bass, I believe. It has these very specific lyrics, but also very you know, that's what I love about it. It's you're able to do something specific without telling the audience exactly what's happening. And a lyric that I will actually pull and use from probably, it's hard to say this, but probably my favorite song in the show, from Summer in Ohio, is when she says, "So I smiled like Mona Lisa and I laid my visa down." First, the rhyme is brilliant. Second, everyone knows how Mona Lisa smiles. Everyone gets it. Everyone knows exactly what it means. And third, you're not just saying exactly what you did. You're implying that you did this through this picture. You know, it's special. I'll stop there. I will go on for hours about it, but
no, don't stop. This is your obsession, kid. Keep talking. It stops me from talking, so you please talk more.
We do Still Hurting. And at that point, Kathy is the one you've been introduced to, and you're rooting for her. You have this woman who is very upset about a breakup with this guy named Jamie. And then you go on to be introduced to Jamie, who you expect to be this bad person, I guess, from hearing the song. And you hear him sing Shiksa Goddess and how wonderfully he's talking about this woman. And you're rooting for him too, which is why I think it's so cool. Because a lot of times you start a show with, you know, that's going in chronological order for every character, and you're rooting for all of them until something happens. But at this point, we're going backwards with her, and we're still rooting for both of them. And then at the end, you go, okay, well, maybe in certain aspects of all of them, I'm not rooting for either of them. It's
very
cool.
As someone who has not been in many a relation, and definitely not long ones, I have many an opinion about both of them and their relation, but that's neither here nor there. My brain truly is all over the place. So I watched a deconstruction on YouTube the other day about the screenplay to Silence of the Lambs. Now, stay with me. There's a reason.
No, I'm with you.
Okay. You're familiar with Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anyone who isn't, Oscar-winning movie from the early 90s, Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, most famously has the character Hannibal Lecter, who is a psychotic cannibal, former psychiatrist. And the, when we are introduced to him in the movie, we are, you know, we are told up until that point, he's in a high security prison and Jodie Foster has to go interview him for this serial killer. And we are told by many people, he's evil incarnate. He's crazy. He's diabolical. He's, you know, he's just pure evil. And the movie, by the way they introduce him, so they have, you have this buildup of what this guy could be like, and you have Jodie Foster walk past all these cells leading up to his cell and sees all the inmates, and you see them get progressively more mentally unhinged. One guy is sort of muttering to himself. Another guy is throwing himself against the bars. Another guy is spitting at her, just getting more and more animalistic, until we get to Hannibal Lecter, who is standing still and looking at her calmly as if he's welcoming her to afternoon tea. And it is such a twist, and it totally goes against what you're thinking. And it translates to what you said with the last 5 years, where you hear Kathy talk about Jamie in this way that's like, this guy who has no respect for her or her feelings, has dropped her, you know, on the side of the road feeling deserted, couldn't care less. How could she ever be with such a monster? And then we go into Shiksa Goddess, where you see this adorably charismatic guy falling head over heels for her. And you're like, oh, not what I was expecting. If you had a tattoo, that wouldn't matter. If you had a shaved head, that would be cool. If you came from Spain or Japan or the back of a van, just as long as you're not from Hebrew school, I'd say now I'm getting somewhere. I'm finally breaking through. I'd say, hey, hey, Shiksa Goddess, I've been waiting for someone like you. But it's also, in its own way, a hint into who Jamie is and what he's going to become, which is, he's a very driven person. He's a very focused person, which is not a crime. You know, there's something to be said about that. But the way he sort of, the song is a list song, in the same way that, you know, 100 Ways to Lose a Man and Wonderful Town is the list song. You know, he's listing all the different ways that he's upsetting his family by falling in love with a non-Jewish girl. He's listing all the Jewish girls he's ever been on dates with. He's listing all the ways that Kathy could be, you know, socially unacceptable, but he'd still be into her.
And could. He uses the word could a lot.
Yes.
It could happen.
It's could
if. I could be in love with someone like you.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these temporary sounding words in here that make it a little bit, like, yes, he's excited, but he also, like, he has this drive that maybe isn't supportive.
Yeah.
And then just, again, going musically, because I'll probably always go here. At the end of the song, he says, I could be in love with someone like you. And he holds it out. And as he's holding it out, this music is spiraling down. And it holds down on this dark tone at the bottom.
I would also like to make a quick note to anyone who's wondering, Norbert Leo Butz, so they recorded the cast album after the show had closed.
Yes.
Because the original production did not do super well. Off-Broadway in general is a very tricky venture. But Norbert Leo Butz, you have Sherry Renee Scott, who's singing it exactly how she did it in the theater. She's like, I, you know, fart these notes out every day. I'm not going to embellish. I'm Sherry Renee Scott. I'm a professional. And she's very grounded. She's a natural actress. Norbert Leo Butz is like, I most likely am never going to sing this score again, especially not like in a recording. I am going to go balls to the walls with my vocals and do things that I never did in the theater, optioning up all the time. And is thus responsible for ruining at least half a dozen wonderful male singers' voices in trying to recreate.
The amount of vocal hemorrhages I probably got from trying to do some Norbert Leo Butzisms, and I don't regret it. I did learn to sing a lot from Norbert Leo Butz. You know, maybe certain technical things I should have done differently because I'm not Norbert Leo Butz, but even acting-wise, acting through a song, he's a master.
They're both wonderful. And we'll get to other interpretations in a second because I want to finish. We're gonna put our foot to the pedal on the plot. We get through We get so also it's important to note the careers of these characters. Kathy is an aspiring actress. Jamie's an aspiring writer, and one of the major conflicts in their relationship is her career as an actress stalls and his career as a writer accelerates. And it doesn't, and part of it is luck of the draw, part of it is drive, part of it is, you know, Kathy is one of Kathy's biggest I'm gonna say flaws, I'm perhaps like hurdles to overcome, is that she's constantly down on herself and she's very easily discouraged. So yeah. One failure is enough to sort of put her on the couch for a week. Whereas Jamie, it's like, you know, a rejection is simply someone who doesn't get him, on to the next. And there's something to be said for her taking some of that energy, but there's also something to be said for him taking some of her humility. He could stand to take some of her humility as well, is what I'm saying. Anywho, so then we go into See I'm Smiling, where we catch Kathy at her latest venture in Ohio. And yeah, how would we describe this song?
Oh, heartbreaking. Oh, so sad. Because you get this idea that he came to visit her, I guess it would be her birthday?
It's on her birthday, yeah.
It's on her birthday. So, he's there, and instead of wanting to spend the time with her, it's clear in the lyrics that he has other commitments that he has to return to New York for.
He's there out of obligation, not to support.
Yeah. So it's she has this rant in the middle of the song, which I think is so unbelievably written, mm-hmm. and orchestrations.
And foreshadowing. It has musical writing foreshadowing in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
The foreshadowing?
Yeah. The lyrics that are used again in
In Summer in Ohio.
No, I Can Do Better Than That.
I Can Do Better Than That. Yes, that's what. Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
Why are you acting brand new?
Well, they're not. Okay, so they're not the same lyrics though.
No, it's the same.
But they are. It's the same framework. Motif. It's the same idea. And oh gosh, they're so good. And I know in your soul it must drive you crazy that you won't get to play with your little girlfriends. No, I'm not. It's all this pent up rage that she probably has already said a bunch of times and still feels this pressure to have to say it more and louder, and you know, but it's all in the writing. It's written really
well. The only thing more frustrating than not having the opportunity to speak your piece is having to speak your piece over and over and over because it's not being understood.
Mm.
So that is something to think about when you are doing that song. Moving on.
Moving too fast. Arguably some people's, you know, favorite song in the show. It's written very well. It's one of my favorite songs in the show. It's fantastic. It shows this the escalation of his career and his well-being. And at all the time, he's talking about them together. Yes, he's talking about himself. I did all these things, but then it leads to him saying, you know, this is all the things that we're going to gain from it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all with his own success, and it's, oh gosh, it's written so well musically, lyrically. It's so good. It's so good. I don't know how much I can say on this song because it's so just. It's.
I mean, musically speaking, again, when you have a really great singer, it's just like, at the risk of sounding misogynistic, it's a panty dropper for me. It's just when you know, not misogynistic because I'm talking about my panties. It definitely butters me up. I will say dramatically, again, it has some foreshadowing there because, as you said, it is very much about his career and what he's gaining. And while he does reference Kathy and it's not about, you know, my happiness, it's more our happiness, it's not her success is not factoring into the song, and what she wants out of life isn't factoring into the song. It's everything he wants that she will be a part of.
Yes, exactly. And throughout all this, it's like a list. He's listing all these accomplishments. He's listing all these things that he wants. And throughout that, musically, we're modulating mm-hmm. up and mm-hmm. up and up to build the tension, build the suspense, build the idea that he's you know, it's gonna blow. It's so smart. We start to take the next step together. Found an apartment on 73rd. The Atlantic Monthly's printing my first chapter. $2,000 without rewriting one word. I left Columbia and I don't regret it. So, Moving Too Fast is over. We now have a part of that.
One of my other favorite songs. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so good. This is another one where you have lots of specificity in the lyrics. And musically, it's the one that if I sit down at the piano and I want to play something like a show tune, mm-hmm. I will open up this book and I will play this song. It's so lovely. It has these optimistic ideas of Kathy saying, you know, it's for us. He's doing stuff for us. It's working. It's fine. Nothing all that bad, at least for her. My dog's growling on the floor. Nothing all that bad for her, as in her mind she's been able to justify things, I think, up to this point. And mm-hmm. now it's getting to the point where she's breaking down and realizing that it's not working.
Yeah.
That it's hard because she, for a lot of reasons, will end up going to blame herself. Mm-hmm. And it's written well. It's done well.
I highly recommend people watch on YouTube the Anna Kendrick version of it. It's her version of part of that is probably my favorite of all the Kathy's, which is, and when I say favorite in terms of any interpretation, everyone understand that I think that everyone's fantastic. So it's a testament to how good that interpretation is of each song than to like drown out anybody else. That is what we need to understand right here, right now. Because in the movie, they sort of portray it over a period of different interviews of book launches for Jamie's new book. You see flashes of her and Jamie in the house. You see his work ethic and how sort of she factors into it, which is truly not at all. And just when you like kind of start to get annoyed at him, the movie shows the dedication in the book, which is to her. And his author photo in the sleeve is the photo she took of him. And you think, oh well, that's so sweet. But then you go back to the book launch and she's alone in the corner of the room, sort of just singing to herself, I'm a part of that, I'm a part of that, aren't I? And it's as you said, fucks with your emotions. And she doesn't play the victim in it. You see her trying to convince herself that she's a part of it, but we also see the cracks.
Yes.
And that comes from from the actor point of view, not projecting, don't project the cracks, project the uncertainty. We will see the cracks.
It hits so much harder. We go on to Shmuel. Oh, Shmuel is so good.
Which is Jamie's showcase song in it's a senior year showcase song.
Fun fact, Jason Robert Brown has a book about Shmuel, a children's book.
Oh, does he really?
That he wrote, yeah.
That's lovely. I'm
assuming it came after the show, but maybe not. Maybe, you know, who knows?
That's what we call synergy. Noodles. That's what we call synergy.
This is one of my favorite songs, orchestration wise. Mm. There's many an interesting thing that the words and the music match up pretty perfectly because the words are very descriptive. And it's a very cool idea of this, you know, he's giving her this song, this idea, this story that he wrote her for Christmas, and basically saying, you got to chase your dreams now or you're going to lose all the time. At least the way I took it, you're going to lose the time if you're not, you know, getting out there and doing everything that you can. And yes, there's so many great things about the song, but the last line is, of course, the one that everyone is going to leave the song loving the most, which is him saying, have I mentioned today how lucky I am to be in love with you, which is so beautiful.
It is
and specific. And lovely.
Yes. And a callback to earlier. And it's just, it's it works in a dramatic sense. It's an emotional line. Yeah. No, Jamie puts on this whole story, as you said, about Shmuel. This, what is he? He's a dressmaker.
Taylor.
He's a tailor. And he gets the chance to have more time to eventually, he gets enough time in the end to go back to his youth and sort of redo his life. And Jamie uses it as an example to Kathy, who wants to be an actress, but is bartending and waitressing and not really going out there, and uses it to motivate her to go out for her dreams, which, you know, is a wonderful sentiment.
It's a wonderful sentiment, of course, if you're that, if your idea of the gift is to showcase your talents and then tell her, use yours, it's, of course, it's going to hit hard in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But the sentiment is lovely.
It is a lovely sentiment. He does motivate her, which is good, because that leads then into the funniest song in the show.
Oh, I agree.
Summer in Ohio.
This, I've mentioned earlier, is my favorite song in the show, I think. Lyrically, the jazziness of it, it's just so unique and goes in so many directions. Musically and lyrically, and it's so there's no kind of A-B rhyme scheme. It's all just woven through, and you get it, and it's just great. And there are, I could pull out of every single line. I could pull out and deconstruct. There's so many great things. There's the Mona Lisa one that I've mentioned. There's the line towards the end where she says, "The torture is just exquisite," while I'm waiting for you to visit, because that is, it's so real. It hurts in the best way, you know, and it's not just saying it hurts in the best way. He has beautiful words to say these things, and it's so smart. And it's a great, and if you haven't heard the Cynthia Erivo version of this, do so, because it's magic.
The Cynthia Erivo version. Also, if you can find it, Lauren Kennedy's version in Chicago, because they did it in Chicago before they brought it
to
New York.
She was the original.
Original, yes. And it's actually, I think it's a full step up from what the key is now. Yes.
Wow. Oh,
Lauren Kennedy could belt you literally any note. It is absolutely insane. There is odd. She was also Emily Skinner's standby in Sideshow. She was the Daisy standby, and there's audio of her in that. And just all, I mean, phenomenal as Emily Skinner is, there are notes that Emily Skinner like doesn't head voice, because she's, you know, a much lower throaty alto, that Lauren Kennedy just full on belts. And you're like, I didn't know I needed that note belted in my life. Now I do.
Can I just, and I implore everyone to fact check me on this, because it may be wrong, but I think, maybe not for that production, but for the Minetta Lane production, I think Kelly O'Hara might have been the understudy for Sherina Scott. And I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that she was introduced to Jason that way, and he loved her so much.
I know that she went in for it. I know she went in for it. I don't know. Well, I don't think she was. I don't think she was actually the understudy. She might have been offered the understudy.
I see.
Because I know exactly what you're talking about. And I saw her in concert at Town Hall with Seth Rudetsky, and she brought up the last 5 years. And I think, I wish I remember the exact specifics of it. I think I talked about it on this pod a while back. I think she was offered the understudy track, even though she wasn't really vocally right for it. They just liked her so much, and they liked what she did with the material. I think she didn't end up taking it. I think she ended up doing Follies instead.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be slammed in the comments.
Yeah, whatever. I get slammed in the comments for talking too much anyway, so.
That to say, you know, if you're maybe not even like 100% right for something, and you think, you know, it's worth making these networking connections, go for it.
Yeah. Or if they tell you you're not right for it, but you think you are, go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, one of my favorite stories is Rebecca Luker, Tony nominated Rebecca Luker, Broadway star Rebecca Luker, when they were doing Music Man the last time, she was like, I need to be seen for this. I am one of the best sopranos on Broadway. And they were like, no, we don't want to see you. And she's like, I am Tony nominee Rebecca Luker. You need to see me. And they're like, no, we don't want to see you. She's like, I've worked with Susan Stroman. You need to see me. And they finally, after like months of being like, see me, she went into the room, booked it, got a Tony nomination. So like, mic drop Rebecca Luker.
Mic drop.
He wants me. He wants me. The
then we have the only time they do whet.
They do whet. And he proposes to her. In the original production, they were in a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Or, is on that stage, how it usually is? I guess it is.
They're yes. supposed to be, yeah, they're supposed to be in a boat in the stage version. Because they're in the reservoir, or not the reservoir, like one of the lakes in Central Park. And he's pointing out, he's pointing out buildings that are surrounding the park. Because she's trying to recognize them and she's getting them all wrong.
Right. And that's how we find out that, you know, it starts with him saying responses to her questions, and the song ends with her questions.
Yes.
And it's so lovely, and, you know, he's so optimistic in his proposal, and she's so, I guess I wouldn't call hers non-optimistic, but the first thing she does is point out her flaws. Mm-hmm. When in response to him, and that's telling. But even then, it's such a beautiful, beautiful song.
But then on top of all that, so like, yes, she starts off with her flaws, but then when they finally overlap together, and because he's singing, "Will you share your life with me for the next 10 minutes?" Sort of like every 10 minutes, we'll sort of recommit to each other. And when they start singing and overlapping, she's singing the word forever, and he keeps on singing the next 10 minutes.
Yes.
So he's like, end game, done. This is going on forever. And he's like, every 10 minutes, we'll just say we love each other. And it's like, is that how you think love should go? I mean, both, there's merit to both. Did you ever see the show You're the Worst?
No.
Are you aware of it?
Maybe. What is it?
It was a show on FX. I think you can watch it on Hulu now. And it basically, like, the idea of it was supposed to be like the anti-romantic comedy. It was like two people who were just very broken and cynical, but they fall in love with each other. And they fit. I mean, it's a very good show, but the show ended essentially with them. I don't know if they legally got married, but they, because the idea of marriage in forever freaks them both out. So they decide to basically just like every day they decide that they're going to still be with each other. And it takes the pressure off of forever. And they're like, at any point we can bail, we'll wake up each morning and decide to recommit to each other. And then I think the beauty of that is like over time, they stopped having to like recommit each day, and it just sort of became the norm. So I understand where Jamie's coming from, but you definitely can sort of see the clashing of ideals as he keeps singing the next 10 minutes and she's singing forever.
And then of course there's his line, which leads into the, I will never change the world until I do, which mm-hmm. can be taken of course two ways. First of all, he says, I will never change the world. Mm-hmm. And then until I do, which could be until I do it by myself with my talents, mm-hmm. or it could be taken until we say I do, mm-hmm. which is.
Yep. Oh, layers, levels and layers.
Layers.
Okay. And then we go into their wedding waltz, which is the waltz we heard at the beginning. We'll hear mm-hmm. it again. And then, as you said, we close off with Kathy's questions to Jamie's answers. And one of my favorite bits of staging, they did it in the original, they did it at second stage, which is in the original, they're on a turntable to sort of represent the passage of time. And at second stage, there was a treadmill. So either way, the boat is going off stage as she's singing. And both Betsy Wolfe and Sharon A. Scott are singing there, you know, is that the so-and-so, is that the so-and-so? And we know that at the end of the questions, Jamie's going to pull out a ring because we saw him do it. We see him pull out a ring and sing Kathy. And both Sharon A. Scott and Betsy Wolfe are singing their bit, like, can we go see the dinosaurs? And then right before the boat goes off stage, you see they're looking down, seeing the ring and gasping. And that's the last image before the song ends. It's
just hits hard.
Yeah. It hits hard. It's emotions.
Forever.
Will you share your life with me?
Forever.
For the next 10 lifetimes.
Forever.
Summers till the world explodes, till there's no one left.
After Moving Too Fast, we now have the song where Jamie officially turns into a dick, in my
opinion. Yeah, officially 100%. They're married. Mm-hmm. Or they're
married.
Yes, they're married. They are married. And he starts thinking that he's not satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find it elsewhere. He can't get it from his writing, and he can't get it from his wife, so he starts going to maybe other women.
Yes. It's framed in the sense that there's the opening line is, everyone tells you the minute you get married, every other woman in the world suddenly finds you attractive. And the gist is that, like, it's not just every woman. It's the kind of women you always wanted to, you know, hook up with. But, and now they want you because you're taken. And his attitude is like, I'm not going to do it. I could never. But, like, look at all of these opportunities. Oh, my God. And it's, he's trying to frame it as, like, I mean, to, you know, reference another douchebag, Louis C.K., who's like, his whole shtick was always like, I'm just speaking the truth that everyone's thinking, right? And sort of that's where Jamie's kind of coming from. He's like, I'm just speaking a truth. Not going to do anything. And it's like, the way you're wording it, the way your attitude is going about it is not helpful, sir.
And I'm pretty sure once upon a time when I watched a bootleg of Norbert doing it, when he says, he's getting all these phone calls and he says, he's leaving Kathy a voicemail, I think, where he's saying, he's leaving. Mm-hmm. And he's coming back to her, and I'm pretty sure he's at a bar and he points to his beer and signals that he wants another one as he's saying it.
That he do. That
boy,
he...
oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
So then in that same song, we go into Climbing Uphill.
Which is what?
Right?
Yeah, it goes in Climbing
Uphill. Which is Kathy doing her darndest, trying to, get her success and not having much luck doing it. And then the whole time, saying, you know, just doubting herself the whole time, doubting everything she's saying, doubting everything she's doing, and just playing really, being really hard on herself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done well. It there's that her audition song, which clearly is written in a way where it's too close to home. Mm-hmm. And it's played in a lot of different ways. She can't quite catch up with it. It's like life is getting thrown at her and she has to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly her subtext, I guess, is that tune while she's auditioning and what she's actually thinking and saying. And it's so brilliant and it seems so real.
Mm-hmm. And they have, very well. And Jason Arbor Brown writes her inner monologue in the song at one point, which I mean, the whole song is obviously an inner monologue, but when there's a moment where we come back to seeing her audition, I think it's like we see her audition 3 or 4 times. You see at one point her doing a completely successful audition where she books it. And then as we go further back in time, you see a lot of the times where it doesn't work out. Either the piano player just goes too fast, he's doing the wrong key. I love it's always up for interpretation how they do it. Like in the movie, he's playing it in completely the wrong key, and Anna Kendrick's like trying to negotiate what key he's actually playing in. And then in the original, you see he plays like a bell tone, which totally throws Cher Renee Scott off. Like you look at her and look off, she's like, what? And then she starts and he's playing it like triple the speed he's supposed to.
Yeah. Oh, it's so great. Oh,
it's so good. But then on top of that, you see her auditioning again and the subtle light change shows what's going on in her head as opposed to what's happening outwardly. And it's all the struggles and insecurities that performers have whenever they audition.
Why is the director staring at his crotch? Why is that man staring at my resume? Don't stare at my resume. I made up half my resume. Look at me. Stop looking at that. Look at me. No, not at my shoes. Don't look at my shoes. I hate these fucking shoes. Why'd I pick these shoes? Why'd I pick this song? Why'd I pick this career? Why does this pianist hate me?
For anyone who's like, why would you put yourself through this? When you have a man who's succeeding so well and can, you know, carry you both to comfort, she has her response, which is that I will not be that girl. I'm not going to be the one who's missing life and missing everything because I'm content with just being provided for. She's like, I need to make something of myself as well.
Yeah.
I have to catch up. And it's just so good. And it doesn't end. And also, calls back to See I'm Smiling, who am I, what am I doing? It cuts off before it can be answered.
Yeah. Oh, it's so great.
It is great. And then it goes into perhaps the most devastatingly ruthless song.
Oof. Yeah. So this tune is one that I sang a lot growing up. And I've nitpicked it down with coaches and it's interesting how many times I would play the positive or they'd be like, I don't think it means that. So he says, if I didn't believe in you and all of the 10,000 women you are, mm-hmm. I was always playing that, like, you're spectacular. You can do anything. But I, you know, and maybe it is that way, but it's got such a negative connotation. It's so,
it's a backhanded compliment for sure. It's
all of it. Yeah. Everything about it is a backhanded compliment.
Yes. It's not even about her. It's about how he feels she's dragging him down. It's a little bit of like a suck it up. Yeah. If I didn't believe in you, and just when you think maybe, just maybe, Jamie could possibly be onto something, he says the most devastating line, which is, "I will not lose because you can't win." Is that the actual?
I will not lose because you. Yeah. I will not lose because you can't win. Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
And in the film,
I will not fail so you can be comfortable. I will not lose because you can't win.
Yes. And the song is devastating as it is. And the film, I really like the interpretation, not just because Jeremy Jordan sings and acts the shit out of it, but because director Richard LeGravenes, again, someone I know well, but I said this to him when I saw the movie, I was like, it's so amazing. He keeps the camera on Anna Kendrick the entire time. The camera is following her and how she's responding to the song, and the color, what little color is left in that girl's face in that song goes completely out the moment that line is uttered. And you just see the clouds come over the eyes, and she's like, he said it, the thing that like, I've always dreaded him saying, the thing that I always thought he was thinking, he just said it, and he didn't say it to hurt me. He said it because he meant it. And she just gets up and she slowly walks into the bathroom and she shuts the door because what can you say after that?
Yeah. You're making me want to, I need to watch the movie again.
I can't say that the movie is perfect. I think it does about as good a job of making a film out of that show as it can. And I think there's a lot, I think it's one of the more successful modern movie adaptations. I also like, they balance live singing and studio singing. So there are times when it's a pre-recording track and times when it's live, and they sort of blend the two. So it's always pleasant to listen to, but it always feels real as well. And that is worth pointing out, Les Miserables. is it real that Hugh Jackman is straining and bring him home? I don't care. It sounds bad.
Oh, no.
There are things that the Les Mis movie gets right, but there are times when they get it wrong for the sake of authenticity.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what's not authentic, Charles?
What?
Singing in public.
That's true.
Singing in four-part harmony while you're having a revolution. That's not authentic.
Sure. I mean, I can't speak for a lot of those things. I sing in public. If there were a revolution, I'd probably be singing at least the tenor or bass part. But it wouldn't be things that I'm making up on the spot. It'd be tunes from the last 5 years that I'm humming.
Yes, bring it on.
If I didn't believe in you, we wouldn't be having this fight. If I didn't believe in you, I would walk out the door and say, Kathy, you're right. But I never could let that go. Knowing the things about you, I know things when I met you 4 years ago. I knew. It never took much convincing to make me believe in you.
I want to get into my favorite song of the show.
Yeah, this one is one of those.
I can do better than that. In truth, I would argue Jamie probably has the best songs in terms of like musical showing off, in terms of like vocal pyrotechnics. I gravitate more towards Kathy's songs just on a dramatic actor level. I think they are phenomenal.
I go back and forth. I agree with you somewhat, but I think I prefer, at this point in my life right now, Kathy's tunes. I think, man, they're all written so well. It's hard.
They are.
I can't like deconstruct this in a bad way whatsoever because it's just so.
If you paid me enough, I'm sure I could.
Yeah, sure. I mean, tell me what to say.
Yeah, I'm a snarky enough asshole that like I'm sure I could find a way to deconstruct this show. I mean, I can't tell you that I find the show to be perfect, but I find the overall effect so good that I can overlook bumps.
Sure. I would not skip a song.
No, I don't think
and
I
that's
ever.
Saying a lot.
But tell me about this song. What do you mean?
So this song, actually, I want you to tell me about this song because you love it so much. And I'll just add in my
have
two
you
cents.
Not acknowledged how much I've spoken already during your obsession?
No, I want to hear it because I want to hear you talk about it.
So this song happens on a car ride. In the story, Jamie is going to meet Kathy's family for the first time. That is, and so what I love about this song and that certain actors, you can see them doing it, is that the song is, it's a both a story song, a list song, and a surprise song in the same way that the Shmuel song kind of has all those things as well. There is an ace up Kathy's sleeve at the end of it, which is that ultimately she's trying to tell Jamie that she wants him to move in with her. That is essentially the purpose of the song. And that everything that's happening in this moment is like leading up to this. And she starts by giving him like a background on her life pre him, what led her to this moment. And it's both, you know, when you're in a relationship, you're sort of letting out your skeletons out of the closet and the people you know,
the
skeletons in the closet. Yeah, all the baggage. She's airing out the baggage and it while also using said moment of airing out baggage to sort of reinforce, I have been through all this, so I know what I want right now, and what I want is you. And the title, I Can Do Better Than That, is reflective of Kathy's refusal to settle. Why she says, I won't be the girl in the burbs, why she won't just settle for performing it in Ohio every summer, why she needs to do more, because that same drive that we see in Jamie, she has it too. She just can be harder on herself, and life has thrown her more curveballs than they have thrown him. So it's easier for her to fall down than it is for him. But this is perhaps the most confident, the funniest, and the most, I already said confident, but I'll say another version of that, which is the most sure of herself and her wants and her needs is in this song.
Which makes it all the more heartbreaking when she talks about a past relationship where she was, someone had left her a note and left. And you know at that point, because you've seen the end of it, that Jamie does the same thing.
Yes. And what I also love about that note with so this is another song where the line has gotten changed over time. It used to be she was dating a guy who looked like Tom Cruise. You could sort of say looked like Tom Cruise, and now it's who had some very well-placed tattoos.
Because
looking like Tom Cruise is not so much a compliment these days.
I think he's handsome.
Oh, he is handsome, but like it's a different connotation in 2020 than it was in 2001.
Yes, sure.
Which is to say that relationship, she wasn't in it because she was in love. She was in it because she was like, this might be the best I get. So like maybe, and then it blows up in her face and she's like, well, fuck that. If I'm going to have something blow up in my face, I want it to be something that I care about, which goes for her relationship, which goes for Jamie. And it's a wonderfully acted song. You see in that song why someone would fall in love with her. You see a very complex person the entire show, but this is truly Summer in Ohio is a great show-stopping song, but there is the humor in it is all the sort of negative aspects of what she's going through and how she's sort of, she's not spinning the positive. She's just making fun of the negative things in her life. I Can Do Better Than That is the first song she sings that's fully positive, where you see the charming and magnetic person that she can be and what makes Jamie so drawn to her. And it's... Yeah. And yeah, and again, similar to Summer in Ohio, it builds vocally very slowly. It's a long song, so it's a marathon. Mm-hmm. So you can't have her belting her tits off right out the gate. It builds. And it also has that section that reflects in CM Smiling, that I want you and you and nothing but you, turns it on its head in a positive, like, I want you.
Mm-hmm.
You are what I want. Not what I need. You are what I want. Which is... If anyone's ever watched Grey's Anatomy, and you know that all the listeners know that I've been into Grey's Anatomy these days, Meredith has a phenomenal line where she says to Derek, I don't need you in my life, Derek. I want you there. Like, there's a difference.
Boom.
Yes.
I don't watch Grey's Anatomy, but that...
The first three seasons are quite fantastic. You don't have to watch any more after that.
I want you, and nothing but you.
of you. Finally, I'll have something worthwhile to think of each morning. You and you and nothing but you. No substitution will do. Nothing but fresh, undiluted, and pure. Top of the line.
And that's what makes the song so effective for me.
Yeah. You said it very well. That's beautiful.
I mean, I went to college.
Wow.
Believe it or not, I have an education in musical theater. Although where I went to college, we were not told outwardly. It was implied that Jason Robert Brown was less than at the place where I went to school. And I understood why they were saying that, but I disagreed with it. And yeah, I still disagree with it.
Of course. I don't think they would probably say it anymore.
No. Well, it was a school where that was like, we really reflect acting and, you know, so you shouldn't be singing pretty all the time. And this specific professor found that he felt Jason Robert Brown stuff was a showcase for pretty singing, not acting. And I think it's a showcase for both.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone would agree with you there.
Yes, I knew this professor was full of shit the moment he said that Audra McDonald was more of a singer than an actress. And I sat there and I went, I will continue my education here, but I will take what you say selectively.
Yeah, there you go. Anywho, then we move on to a sad, 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 sad song.
The nail in the coffin of the relationship.
The nail in the coffin, where Jimmy has, in the movie, it shows him cheating multiple times, I believe, in the song.
Including with the woman that Kathy accused him of cheating on her with.
Yes, correct. And it's just him talking, basically just him trying to explain things for himself, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was his easy way out.
Yes.
And it's sad and, you know, I guess it's great that Kathy didn't have to end up, you know, just putting up with it anymore, and it ends there, but it's sad to listen to.
And the musical on stage is very deliberate in not making it clear who he's singing to, mm-hmm. which I think is very important, because it leaves it open to interpretation if he has been cheating and Kathy was right, or if Kathy's suspicions and the tension in the relationship eventually led him to cheat. Which is, again, open to director and actor interpretation. The movie states explicitly, she's been right this whole time. Again, as you said, multiple women, including the woman that she accused him with. And then the final lyric of the song
is, of course, refers back to Chicks a Goddess, and where he says, I could be in love with someone like you. And on the you, I think there's a key change. So it's like almost like it's a new chapter. It's mm-hmm. somebody else. There's this whole it's done at that mm-hmm. point. It's like I have moved on.
And you also find out that this song takes place right before See I'm Smiling, because he has to go to Ohio to see her. So she was so fucking right when she says, you and your little playthings, and
so
tries
sad.
To gaslight her, and she's like, stop it, I know, just stop it.
Oh, it makes me mad. Oh boy.
Doesn't it just? And you're like, he's not real. The emotions are real. The person is not. Anyway, then we go on to the ending.
Then we go into the ending.
Which to me is honestly, her Goodbye Until Tomorrow for me is, I find it sexy as hell, in the way that like a first date, a good first date is sexy.
You feel it. You love it. You're so happy for her. She, you know, what's happened, and it's still such a great song. She puts the words in perfectly, and at the same time, when she's talking about him leaving from their first date, he is there singing about him leaving for good.
Yes.
And I guess they don't really sing together. They're not singing together, but, you know, they sing.
At the same
time.
They
will sing in the song. Yeah.
Yes. Her lyrics are, you know, goodbye until tomorrow, and his are just goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's leaving the letter that she's going to find. Anyone who's dated in New York City and has had a really great first date in New York City completely understands the music that begins Goodbye Until Tomorrow. That intimacy, like when you have a really great first date that ends with a really wonderful kiss, because New York City is a very public place. Even though people really don't care about you or what's going on with you, everyone's in their own world, it still feels like a very public place. So no one likes to sort of put their intimacy out in the open. But there's something about a really great first date and ending with a really good kiss where it's like, you say, it's like, fuck it. I'm going to do it because it feels right. And then everything just sort of kind of goes away as it happens. To quote another Jason Harper Brown song, it all fades away.
Boom.
Boom.
Don't kiss me goodbye again. Leave this night clean and quiet. You want the last word. You want me to laugh, but leave it for now. All you can say, all you can feel, was wrapped up inside that one perfect kiss. Leave it at that. I'll watch you turn the corner and go. And goodbye until tomorrow.
Yeah, and then they end on the same word, goodbye, which on the same notes in unison. And then it goes into that beautiful waltz where it just fizzles down to that last note and then ends.
His final song is I Could Never Rescue You, which is the melody for that waltz. I love about the double meaning of those lyrics of I'll be waiting, because she starts with I have been waiting. You know, I've gotten to this point. I know now what I'm looking for, what I've gone through, and you're it. So I have been waiting for this, which means I will continue to wait because I know this is worth it. But as you said, also has the other meaning of, in, you know, for the audience knowing in this relationship, she's going to be the one who's always waiting while he does what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we close.
That was a brief dissection of the last 5 years.
Yeah.
We will be joining weekly to discuss it.
Yes. Join us next week when we discuss every other production of this show. So to someone who's coming to this recording for the first time, would you recommend the original recording first?
I don't know. I mean, it hasn't made me dislike any other recordings as some recordings do. It is the one I prefer because I went to it first.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the most raw. Mm-hmm. In terms of just the recording process more than anything else. Just the way that it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Because, nothing to do with the singers, nothing to do with maybe lyric changes or orchestration changes. It feels like you're sitting down and like a concept album. Like it feels like you can just sit and live with these characters for an hour or however long it is.
Yeah. Is that the advice you would give to someone listening to it for the first time? Just sort of like take it all in. Imagine it.
Yeah, oh yeah, sit down, listen. Don't skip around, just listen through.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully there are not people who, there are going to be people listening to it for the first time, but if you've heard songs from the show, I hope you've been interested enough to learn them all.
You've already kind of touched on it, but just to sort of cap it off now that we're coming to the close, what makes you keep coming back to it?
It's a real story. I mean, it's very real. It's written without any guard up. You can see the flaws in both the characters. You can find the things you love about both the characters. The music is to die for. The lyrics are some of the most experimental, and they kind of just fit together like a puzzle. It's and a hard puzzle. It's it's something you have to think about them, and you could keep finding new things, whether it be the orchestrations or the music or the lyrics. There's so many great things that are so relatable, whoever you are in whatever relationship you're in, you know, whether it be a good or bad one, because there's good and bad stuff in this. There's good and bad stuff in lots of things, but you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be viewed as a tragic piece all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Charles, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. This has been
wonderful. Where can people find you?
I'm mostly just on Instagram at Chaz A. Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
Follow if you want.
Yeah. There will be a preamble before this episode where people can donate. There'll also be one in the description box. Any donations right now that you would like people to be aware of to maybe donate to, or places where they can educate themselves from?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. Go on your Instagram, find as many as you want to donate to. There's no wrong answer in this. You can, well, there are some wrong answers, but I think for the most part, people are sharing the ones that are the right answers. So, you know, go to the people you trust, go to the people trying to make a change, donate. There's one that I'm really fighting for right now. It's Broadway for Racial Justice. It's basically trying to make theater in Broadway a safe space for everybody. You know, that we don't want anybody uncomfortable, and we want to make sure all the right people are able to you know, come in and make decisions that are helpful for everybody, that support everybody, that make Broadway a comfortable and safe space, or theater a comfortable and safe space for everybody.
That's fantastic. That's
Broadway for Racial Justice. There's a PayPal in their Instagram,
and you can see the link for that in our description. Charles, we close out every episode with a Broadway diva. You get to choose the Broadway diva, although keep in mind, we've already done Cheri Renee Scott and Anna Kendrick. So if you wanted to keep it last 5 years themed, those are taken. But if you wanted to do someone else that's not last 5 years themed, I would recommend that as well.
Okay. Do I just have to, pick a Broadway diva?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Can you just play Adrienne Warren?
Yeah. I didn't want to say anything. I was hoping you'd say her, but I didn't want to, I wasn't going to push you, but that's who I really wanted.
I would push you for not doing it.
No, I wish there was an official recording of Shuffle Along, because my God, would I want her audio from that, but I will settle for Tina.
Yes.
Yes. No, absolutely. Adrienne Warren. Right. Thank you. I'm so pleased that you said that. I was afraid you were going to be like, this person.
No.
Thank you. Perfect. All right. So in the meantime, guys, thank you for listening. You can check out The Last 5 Years literally anywhere. There are 3 major recordings of it. All are worthwhile. And in the meantime, guys, keep on keeping on. Stay safe. Stay positive. Stay active. This is Broadway Breakdown, and this is Adrienne Warren. Bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.